strong man. Horses are different. All they have is oats and hay, and what they drop is clean and natural. I work with Mr. Hannon after school on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and a half day on Saturday morning. And that means 3 shillings for my mother, though she worries all the time over my eyes. The minute I get home, she washes them and makes me rest them for half an hour. Mr. Hannon says he'll wait near Leamy's school for me on Thursday after his deliveries on Barrington Street. Now the boys will see me. Now they'll know I'm a working man and more than a scabby-eyed blubbergob dancing Jap. Mr. Hannon says, up you get. And I climb up on the float like any working man. I look at the boys gawking at me. Gawking. I tell Mr. Hannon, if he wants to smoke his pipe in comfort, I'll take the reins. And when he hands them over, I'm sure I hear the boys gasping. I tell the horse, gupboard that, like Mr. Hannon. We trot away, and I know dozens of Leamy's boys are committing the deadly sin of envy. I tell the horse again, gupboard that, to make sure everyone heard. To make sure they know I'm driving that float and no one else. To make sure they'll never forget it was me they saw on that float with the reins and the whip. It's the best day of my life. Better than my first communion day, which Grandma ruined. Better than my confirmation day when I had the typhoid. They don't call me names anymore. They don't laugh at my scabby eyes. They want to know how I got such a good job at 11 years of age and what I'm paid, and if I'll have that job forever. They want to know if there are any other good jobs going in the coal yards and would I put in a good word for them. Then there are big boys of 13 who stick their faces in mine and say they should have that job because they're bigger and I'm nothing but a scrawny little runt with no shoulders. They can talk as much as they like. I have the job, and Mr. Hannon tells me I'm powerful. There are days his legs are so bad he can hardly walk at all, and you can see Mrs. Hannon worries. She gives me a mug of tea, and I watch her roll up his trouser legs and peel away the dirty bandages. The sores are red and yellow and clogged with coal dust. She washes them with soapy water and smears them with a yellow ointment. She props the legs up on a chair, and that's where he stays the rest of the night, reading the paper or a book from the shelf above his head. The legs are getting so bad, he has to get up an hour earlier in the morning to get the stiffness out, to put on another dressing. It's still dark one Saturday morning when Mrs. Hannon knocks at our door and asks me if I'd go to a neighbour and borrow their handcart to take on the float. For Mr. Hannon will never be able to carry the bags today, and maybe I just roll them on the handcart for him. He won't be able to carry me on his bicycle, so I can meet him at the yard with the handcart. The neighbour says, anything for Mr. Hannon, God bless him. I wait at the gate of the coal yard and watch him cycle toward me, slower than ever. He's so stiff he can hardly get off the bike, and he says, you're a great man, Frankie. He lets me get the horse ready, though I still have trouble getting on the harness. He lets me handle the float out of the yard and into the frosty streets, and I wish I could drive forever and never go home. Mr. Hannon shows me how to pull the bags to the edge of the float and drop them to the ground, so that I can pull them onto the handcart and push them to the houses. He tells me how to lift and push the bags without straining myself, and we have the 16 bags delivered by noon. I wish the boys at Leamy's could see me now, the way I drive the horse and handle the bags, the way I do everything while Mr. Hannon rests his legs. I wish they could see me pushing the handcart to South's pub and having my lemonade with Mr. Hannon and Uncle Pa, and me all black and Bill Galvin all white. I'd like to show the world the tips Mr. Hannon lets me keep. 4 shillings. And the shilling he gives me for the morning's work, 5 shillings altogether. Mam is sitting by the fire, and when I hand her the money, she looks at me, drops it in her lap, and cries. I'm puzzled, because money is supposed to make you happy. Look at your eyes, she says. Go to that glass and look at your eyes. My face is black, and the eyes are worse than ever. The whites and the eyelids are red, and the yellow stuff oozes to the corners and out over the lower lids. If the ooze sits a while, it forms a crust that has to be picked off or washed away. Mam says, that's the end of it. No more Mr. Hannon. I tried to explain to her that Mr. Hannon needs me. He can barely walk anymore. I had to do everything this morning, drive the float, wheel the handcart with the bags, sit in the pub, drink lemonade, listen to the men discussing who is the best, Rommel or Montgomery. She says she's sorry for Mr. Hannon's troubles, but we have troubles of our own, and the last thing she needs now is a blind son stumbling through the streets of Limerick. Bad enough you nearly died of the typhoid, now you want to go blind on top of it. And I can't stop crying now because this was my one chance to be a man and bring home the money the telegram boy never brought from my father. I can't stop crying because I don't know what Mr. Hannon is going to do on Monday morning when he has no one to help him pull the bags to the edge of the float, to push the bags into the houses. I can't stop crying because of the way he is with that horse he calls Sweet, because he's so gentle himself. And what will the horse do if Mr. Hannon isn't there to take him out? If I'm not there to take him out, will that horse fall down hungry for the want of oats and hay and the odd apple? Mam says I shouldn't be crying. It's bad for the eyes. She says, we'll see. That's all I can tell you now. We'll see. She washes my eyes and gives me sixpence to take Malachy to the Lyric to see Boris Karloff and the Men That Could Not Hang and have two pieces of Cleve's toffee. It's hard to see the screen with the yellow stuff oozing from my eyes, and Malachy has to tell me what's happening. People around us tell him, shut up. They'd like to hear what Boris Karloff is saying. And when Malachy talks back to them and tells them he's only helping his blind brother, they call the man in charge, Frank Goggin. And he says, if he hears another word out of Malachy, he'll throw the two of us out. I don't mind. I have a way of squeezing the stuff out of one eye and clearing it, so that I can see the screen while the other eye fills up, and I go back and forth, squeeze, look, and everything I see is yellow. Monday morning, Mrs. Hannon is knocking on our door again. She asks Ma'am if Frank would ever go down to the coal yard and tell the man in the office that Mr. Hannon can't come in today, that he has to see a doctor about his legs, that he'll surely be in tomorrow, and what he can't deliver today, he will tomorrow. Mrs. Hannon always calls me Frank now. Anyone that delivers hundredweights of coal is not a Frankie. The man in the office says, I think we're very tolerant with Hannon. You? What's your name? McCourt, sir. Tell Hannon we'll need a note from the doctor. Do you understand that?
I do, sir.
The doctor tells Mr. Hannon he has to go to the hospital, or it's a case of gangrene he'll have, and the doctor won't be responsible. The ambulance takes Mr. Hannon away, and my big job is gone. Now I'll be white like everyone else in Leamy's, no float, no horse, no shillings to bring home to my mother. In a few days, Bridie Hannon comes to our door. She says her mother would like me to come and see her, have a cup of tea with her. Mrs. Hannon is sitting by the fire with her hand on the seat of Mr. Hannon's chair. Sit down, Frank, she says. And when I go to sit on one of the ordinary kitchen chairs, she says, no, sit here. Sit here on the chair of himself. Do you know how old he is, Frank?
Oh, he must be very old, Mrs. Hannon. He must be 35.
She smiles. She has lovely teeth. He's 49, Frank, and a man that age shouldn't have legs like that.
He shouldn't, Mrs. Hannon.
Did you know you were a joy to him going around on that float?
I didn't, Mrs. Hannon.
You were. We had two daughters, Bridie that you know, and Kathleen, the nurse above in Dublin. But no son, and he said you gave him the feeling of a son. I feel my eyes burning, and I don't want her to see me crying, especially when I don't know why I'm crying. That's all I do lately. Is it the job? Is it Mr. Hannon? My mother says, all your bladder is near your eye. I think I'm crying because of the quiet way Mrs. Hannon is talking, and she's talking like that because of Mr. Hannan.
Like a son, she says, and I'm glad he had that feeling. His working days are over, you know. He has to stay at home from this out. There might be a cure. And if there is, sure, he might be able to get a job as a watchman where he doesn't have to be lifting and hauling.
I won't have a job anymore, Mrs. Hannan.
You have a job, Frank. School, that's your job.
That's not a job, Mrs. Hannan.
You'll never have another job like it, Frank. It breaks Mr. Hannan's heart to think of you dragging bags of coal off a float, and it breaks your mother's heart and 'twill destroy your eyes. God knows I'm sorry I ever got you into this, for it had your poor mother caught between your eyes and Mr. Hannan's legs.
Can I go to the hospital to see Mr. Hannan?
They might not let you in, but surely you can come here to see him. God knows he won't be doing much but reading and looking out the window.
Ma'am tells me at home, you shouldn't cry, but then again, tears are salty, and they'll wash the bad stuff from your eyes.
There's a letter from Dad. He's coming home 2 days before Christmas. He says everything will be different. He's a new man. He hopes we're good boys, obeying our mother, attending to our religious duties. And he's bringing us all something for Christmas. Ma'am takes me to the railway station to meet him. The station is always exciting, with all the coming and going. People leaning from carriages, crying, smiling, waving goodbye, the train hooting and calling, chugging away in clouds of steam, people sniffling on the platform, the railway tracks silvering into the distance, on to Dublin and the world beyond. Now it's near midnight and cold on the empty platform. A man in a railway cap asks us if we'd like to wait in a warm place. Ma'am says, thank you very much, and laughs when he leads us to the end of the platform, where we have to climb a ladder to the signal tower. It takes her a while because she's heavy, and she keeps saying, oh God, oh God. We're above the world, and it's dark in the signal tower, except for the lights that blink red and green and yellow when the man bends over the board. He says, I'm just having a bit of supper, and you're welcome. Ma'am says, ah, no thanks. We couldn't take your supper from you. He says, the wife always makes too much for me, and if I was up in this tower for a week, I wouldn't be able to eat it. Sure, it's not hard work looking at lights and pulling on the odd lever. He takes the top off a flask and pours cocoa into a mug. Here, he says to me, put yourself outside that cocoa. He hands Ma'am half a sandwich. Ah, no, she says. Surely you could take that home to your children. I have two sons, missus, and they're off there fighting in the forces of His Majesty the King of England. One did his bit with Montgomery in Africa, and the other one is over in Burma or some other bloody place. Excuse the language. We get our freedom from England, and then we fight our wars. So here, missus, take the bit of sandwich. Lights on the board are clicking, and the man says, your train is coming, missus. Thank you very much, and happy Christmas. Happy Christmas to yourself, missus, and a happy new year, too. Mind yourself on that ladder, young fella. Help your mother. Thank you very much, sir. We wait again on the platform while the train rumbles into the station. Carriage doors open, and a few men with suitcases step to the platform and hurry toward the gate. There's a clanking of milk cans dropped to the platform. A man and two boys are unloading newspapers and magazines. There's no sign of my father. Ma'am says he might be asleep in one of the carriages, but we know he hardly sleeps even in his own bed. She says the boat from Holyhead might have been late, and that would make him miss the train. The Irish Sea is desperate at this time of the year. He's not coming, ma'am. He doesn't care about us. He's just drunk over there in England.
Don't talk about your father like that.
I say no more to her. I don't tell her I wish I had a father like the man in the signal tower who gives you sandwiches and cocoa. Next day, Dad walks in the door. His top teeth are missing, and there's a bruise under his left eye. He says the Irish Sea was rough, and when he leaned over the side, his teeth dropped out. Mam says, "It wouldn't be the drink, would it? It wouldn't be a fight." "Ach, no, Angela." Michael says, "You said you have something for us, Dad." "Oh, I do." He takes a box of chocolates from his suitcase, hands it to Mam. She opens the box and shows us the inside where half the chocolates are gone. "Could you spare it?" she says. She shuts the box and puts it on the mantelpiece. "We'll have chocolates after our Christmas dinner tomorrow." Mam asks him if he brought any money. He tells her times are hard, jobs are scarce, and she says, "Is it cotton me you are? There's a war on, there's nothing but jobs in England. You drank the money, didn't you?" "You drank the money, Dad, you drank the money, Dad, you drank the money, Dad." We're shouting so loud, Alfie begins to cry. Dad says, "Och, boys, now boys, respect for your father." He puts on his cap. He has to see a man. Mam says, "Go see your man, but don't come home drunk to this house tonight singing Roddy McCauley or anything else." He comes home drunk, but he's quiet and passes out on the floor next to Mam's bed. We have a Christmas dinner next day because of the food voucher Mam got from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. We have sheep's head, cabbage, floury white potatoes, and a bottle of cider because it's Christmas. Dad says he's not hungry, he'll have tea. Borrows a cigarette from Mam. She says, "Eat something. It's Christmas." He tells her again he's not hungry, but if no one else wants them, he'll eat the sheep's eyes. He says there's great nourishment in the eye, and we all make sounds of disgust. He washes them down with his tea and smokes the rest of his woodbine. He puts on his cap and goes upstairs for his suitcase. Mam says, "Where are you going?" "London. On this day of our Lord, Christmas Day." "It's the best day for travel. People in motor cars will always give the working man a lift to Dublin. They think of the hard times of the Holy Family." "And how will you get on the boat to Holyhead without a penny in your pocket?" "The way I came. There's always a time when they're not looking." He kisses each of us on the forehead, tells us be good boys, obey Mam, say our prayers. He tells Mam he'll write, and she says, "Oh yes, the way you always did." He stands before her with his suitcase. She gets up, takes down the box of chocolates, and hands them around. She puts a chocolate in her mouth and takes it out again because it's too hard and she can't chew it. I have a soft one, and I offer it for the hard one, which will last longer. It's creamy and rich, and there's a nut in the middle. Malachy and Michael complain they didn't get a nut. "And why is it Frank always gets the nut?" Mam says, "What do you mean, always? This is the first time we ever had a box of chocolates." Malachy says, "He got the raisin in the bun at school, and all the boys said he gave it to Paddy Clossy, so why couldn't he give us the nut?" Mam says, "Because 'tis Christmas, and he has sore eyes, and the nut is good for the sore eyes." Michael says, "Will the nut make his eyes better?" "'Twill." "Will it make one eye better, or will it make two eyes better?" "The two eyes, I think." Malachy says, "If I had another nut, I'd give it to him for his eyes." Mam says, "I know you would." Dad watches us a moment, eating our chocolates. He lifts the latch, goes out the door, and pulls it shut. Mam tells Bridie Hannan, "Days are bad, but nights are worse, and will this rain ever stop?" She tries to ease the bad days by staying in bed and letting Malachy and me light the fire in the morning while she sits up in the bed, passing Alfie bits of bread and holding the mug to his mouth for the tea that's in it. We have to go downstairs to Ireland to wash our faces in the basin under the tap and try to dry ourselves in the old damp shirt that hangs over the back of a chair. She makes us stand by the bed to see if we left rings of dirt around our necks, and if we did, it's back down to the tap in the damp shirt. When there's a hole in a pair of pants, she sits up and patches it with any rag she can find. We wear short pants till we're 13 or 14, and our long stockings always have holes to be darned. If she has no wool for the darning and the stockings are dark, we can blacken our ankles with shoe polish for the respectability that's in it. It's a terrible thing to walk the world with skin showing through the holes of our stockings. When we wear them week after week, the holes grow so big we have to pull the stocking forward under the toes so that the hole in the back is hidden in the shoe. On rainy days, the stockings are soggy, and we have to hang them before the fire at night and hope they'll be dry by morning. Then they're hard with dirt cake, and we're afraid to pull them on our feet for fear they'll fall on the floor in bits before our eyes. We might be lucky enough to get our stockings on, but then we have to block the holes in our shoes, and I fight with my brother Malachi over any scrap of cardboard or paper in the house. Michael is only 6, and he has to wait for anything left over, unless Mam threatens us from the bed that we're to help our small brother. She says, "If ye don't fix your brother's shoes and I have to get out of this bed, there will be wigs on the green." You'd have to feel sorry for Michael, because he's too old to play with Alfie, and too young to play with us, and he can't fight with anyone for the same reasons. The rest of the dressing is easy. The shirt I wore to bed is the shirt I wear to school. I wear it day in, day out. It's the shirt for football, for climbing walls, for robbing archers. I go to mass in the confraternity in that shirt, and people sniff the air and move away. If Mam gets a docket for a new one at the St. Vincent de Paul, the old shirt is promoted to towel and hangs damp on the chair for months, or Mam might use bits of it to patch other shirts. She might even cut it up and let Alfie wear it a while before it winds up on the floor, pushed against the bottom of the door to block the rain from the lane. We go to school through lanes and back streets so that we won't meet the respectable boys who go to the Christian Brothers School or the rich ones who go to the Jesuit school, Crescent College. The Christian Brothers boys wear tweed jackets, warm woolen sweaters, shirts, ties, and shiny new boots. We know they're the ones who'll get the jobs in the civil service and help the people who run the world. The Crescent College boys wear blazers and school scarves tossed around their necks and over their shoulders to show their cock of the walk. They have long hair which falls across their foreheads and over their eyes so that they can toss their quiffs like Englishmen. We know they're the ones who will go to university, take over the family business, run the government, run the world. We'll be the messenger boys on bicycles who deliver their groceries, or we'll go to England to work on the building sites. Our sisters will mind their children and scrub their floors, unless they go off to England too. We know that. We're ashamed of the way we look, and if boys from the rich schools pass remarks, we'll get into a fight and wind up with bloody noses or torn clothes. Our masters will have no patience with us and our fights because their sons go to the rich schools, and ye have no right to raise your hands to a better class of people, so ye don't. You never know when you might come home and find Mam sitting by the fire, chatting with a woman and a child. Strangers. Always a woman and a child. Mam finds them wandering the streets, and if they ask, "Could you spare a few pennies, miss?" her heart breaks. She never has money, so she invites them home for tea and a bit of fried bread. And if it's a bad night, she let them sleep by the fire on a pile of rags in the corner. The bread she gives them always means less for us. And if we complain, she says, there are always people worse off, and we can surely spare a little from what we have. Michael is just as bad. He brings home stray dogs and all men. You never know when you'll find a dog in the bed with him. There are dogs with sores, dogs with no ears, no tails. There's a blind greyhound he found in the park, tormented by children. Michael fought off the children, picked up the greyhound that was bigger than himself, and told Mam the dog could have his supper. Mam says, "What supper? We're lucky if there's a cut of bread in the house." Michael tells her the dog can have his bread. Mam says that dog has to go tomorrow, and Michael cries all night and cries worse in the morning when he finds the dog dead in the bed beside him. He won't go to school because he has to dig a grave outside where the stable was, and he wants all of us to dig with him and say the rosary. Maliki says it's useless saying prayers for a dog. How do you know he was even a Catholic? Michael says, of course he was a Catholic dog. Didn't I have him in my arms? He cries so hard over the dog, Mam lets us all stay at home from school. We're so delighted we don't mind helping Michael with the grave, and we say three Hail Marys. We're not going to stand there wasting a good day off from school saying the rosary for a dead greyhound. Michael is only six, but when he brings home all men, he manages to get the fire going and gives them tea. Mam says it's driving her crazy to come home and find these old men drinking out of her favourite mug and mumbling and scratching by the fire. She tells Bridie Hannan that Michael has a habit of bringing home old men all a bit gone in the head, and if he doesn't have a bit of bread for them, he knocks on neighbours' doors and has no shame begging for it. In the end, she tells Michael, no more old men. One of them left us with lice and we're plagued. The lice are disgusting, worse than rats. They're in our heads and ears, and they sit in the hollows of our collarbones. They dig into our skin, they get into the seams of our clothes, and they're everywhere in the coats we use as blankets. We have to search every inch of Alfie's body because he's a baby and helpless. The lice are worse than the fleas. Lice squat and suck, and we can see our blood through their skins. Fleas jump and bite, and they're clean, and we prefer them. Things that jump are cleaner than things that squat. We all agree there will be no more stray women and children, dogs and old men. We don't want any more diseases and infections. Michael cries. Grandma's next-door neighbour, Mrs. Purcell, has the only wireless in her lane. The government gave it to her because she's old and blind. I want a radio. My grandmother is old, but she's not blind. And what's the use of having a grandmother who won't go blind and get a government radio? Sunday nights, I sit outside on the pavement, under Mrs. Purcell's window, listening to plays on the BBC and Radio Éireann, the Irish station. You can hear plays by O'Casey, Shaw, Ibsen, and Shakespeare himself, the best of all, even if he is English. Shakespeare is like mashed potatoes. You can never get enough of him. And you can hear strange plays about Greeks plucking out their eyes because they married their mothers by mistake. One night, I'm sitting under Mrs. Purcell's window, listening to Macbeth. Her daughter, Kathleen, sticks her head out the door. Come in, Frankie. My mother says you'll catch the consumption sitting on the ground in this weather. Ah, no, Kathleen, it's all right. No, come in. They give me tea and a grand cut of bread slathered with blackberry jam. Mrs. Purcell says, do you like the Shakespeare, Frankie? I love the Shakespeare, Mrs. Purcell. Oh, he's music, Frankie, and he has the best stories in the world. I don't know what I'd do with myself of a Sunday night if I didn't have the Shakespeare. When the play finishes, she lets me fiddle with the knob on the radio, and I roam the dial for distant sounds in the shortwave band, strange whispering and hissing, the whoosh of the ocean coming and going, and the Morse code, dit-dit-dit-dot. I hear mandolins, guitars, Spanish bagpipes, the drums of Africa, boatmen wailing on the Nile. I see sailors on watch sipping mugs of hot cocoa. I see cathedrals, skyscrapers, cottages. I see Bedouins in the Sahara and the French Foreign Legion, cowboys on the American prairie. I see goats skipping along the rocky coast of Greece where the shepherds are blind because they marry their mothers by mistake. I see people chatting in cafes, sipping wine, strolling on boulevards and avenues. I see night women in doorways, monks chanting vespers. And here is the great boom of Big Ben. This is the BBC Overseas Service, and here is the news. Mrs. Purcell says, leave that on, Frankie, so we'll know the state of the world. after the news, there is the American Armed Forces Network. And it's lovely to hear the American voices easy and cool. And here is the music, oh man, the music of Duke Ellington himself, telling me take the A train to where Billie Holiday sings only to me. Oh, Billy, Billy, I want to be in America with you and all that music, where no one has bad teeth, people leave food on their plates, every family has a lavatory, and everyone lives happily ever after. And Mrs. Purcell says, do you know what, Frankie? What, Mrs. Purcell? That Shakespeare is that good, he must have been an Irishman. The rent man is losing his patience. He tells ma'am, 4 weeks behind you are, missus. That's £1.2. This has to stop, for I have to go back to the office and report to Sir Vincent Nash that the McCourts are a month behind. Where am I then, missus? Out on my arse, jobless, and a mother to support that's 92 and a daily communicant in the Franciscan church. The rent man collects the rents, missus, or he loses the job. I'll be back next week, and if you don't have the money, £1.8.6 total, 'tis out on the pavement you'll be with the skies dripping on your furniture. Ma'am comes back up to Italy and sits by the fire, wondering where in God's name she'll get the money for a week's rent, never mind the arrears. She'd love a cup of tea, but there's no way of boiling the water. Till Maliki pulls a loose board off the wall between the two upstairs rooms. Ma'am says, well, 'tis off now, and we might as well chop it up for the fire. We boil the water and use the rest of the wood for the morning tea, but what about tonight and tomorrow and ever after? Ma'am says, one more board from that wall, one more and not another one. She says that for 2 weeks till there's nothing left but the beam frame. She warns us we are not to touch the beams, for they hold up the ceiling and the house itself. Oh, we'd never touch the beams. She goes to see Grandma, and it's so cold in the house, I take the hatchet to one of the beams. Maliki cheers me on, and Michael claps his hands with excitement. I pull on the beam. The ceiling groans, and down on Mam's bed there's a shower of plaster, slates, rain. Maliki says, oh God, we'll all be killed. And Michael dances around singing, Frankie broke the house, Frankie broke the house. We run through the rain to tell Mam the news. She looks puzzled with Michael chanting, Frankie broke the house, till I explain there's a hole in the house and it's falling down. She says, Jesus, and runs through the streets with Grandma trying to keep up. Ma'am sees her bed buried under plaster and slates and pulls at her hair. What'll we do at all? Screams at me for interfering with the beams. Grandma says, I'll go to the landlord's office and tell them fix this before ye are all drowned entirely. She's back in no time with the rent man. He says, great God in heaven, where's the other room? Grandma says, what room? I rented ye 2 rooms up here and one is gone. Where is that room? Ma'am says, what room? There were 2 rooms up here and now there's one. What happened to the wall? There was a wall. Now there's no wall. I distinctly remember a wall because I distinctly remember a room. Now where is that wall and where is that room? Grandma says, I don't remember a wall. And if I don't remember a wall, how can I remember a room? Ye don't remember? Well, I remember. 40 years a landlord's agent, and I never seen the likes of this. By God, 'tis a desperate situation altogether, when you can't turn your back, but tenants are not paying the rent and making walls and rooms disappear on top of it. I want to know where that wall is and what ye did with that room, so I do. Ma'am turns to us. Do any of ye remember a wall? Michael pulls at her hand. Is that the wall we burned in the fire? The rent man says, dear God in heaven, this beats Banagher. This takes the bloody biscuit. This is going beyond the beyonds.
No rent. And what am I to tell Sir Vincent below in the office? Out, missus, I'm putting ye out. 1 week from today I'll knock on this door, and I want to find nobody at home. Everybody out, never to return. Do you have me, missus?
Ma'am's face is tight. 'Tis a pity you weren't alive in the times when the English were evicting us and leaving us on the side of the road.
No lip, missus, or I'll send the men to put ye out tomorrow.
He goes out the door and leaves it open to show what he thinks of us. Ma'am says, I don't know, in God's name, what I'm going to do.
Grandma says, well, I don't have room for ye, but your cousin Gerald Griffin is living out the Rossbryan Road in that little house of his mother's, and he'd surely be able to take ye in till better times come. 'Tis all hours of the night, but I'll go up and see what he says, and Frank can come with me.
She tells me put on a coat, but I don't have one, and she says, I suppose there's no use in asking ye if ye have an umbrella either. Come on. She pulls the shawl over her head, and I follow her out the door, up the lane, through the rain to Rossbryan Road, nearly 2 miles away. She knocks on the door of a little cottage, in a long row of little cottages.
Are you there, Lemon? I know you're in there. Open the door.
Grandma, why are you calling him Lemon? Isn't his name Gerard?
How would I know?
Do I know why the world calls your Uncle Pat Ab?
Everyone calls this fella Lemon.
Open the door. We'll go in. He might be working overtime. She pushes the door. It's dark, and there's a damp, sweet smell in the room. This room looks like the kitchen, and there's a smaller room next to it. There's a little loft above the bedroom with a skylight where the rain is beating. There are boxes everywhere. Newspapers, magazines, bits of food, mugs, empty tins. We can see two beds taking up all the space in the bedroom, a great acre of a bed, and a smaller one near the window. Grandma pokes at a lump in the big bed.
Lemon, is that you? Get up, will you? Get up.
What?
There's trouble. Angela is getting evicted with the children, and 'tis delving out of the heavens. They need a bit of shelter till they get on their feet, and I have no room for them. You could put them up in the loft, if you like, but that wouldn't do, because the small ones wouldn't be able to climb, and they'd fall down and get killed, so you go up there and they can move in here.
All right.
He hoists himself from the bed, and there's a whiskey smell. He goes to the kitchen and pulls the table to the wall for his climb to the loft.
Grandma says, that's fine now. You can move up here tonight, and you won't have the eviction men coming after ye.
Grandma tells Ma'am she's going home. She's tired and drenched, and she's not 25 anymore. She says there's no need to be taking beds or furniture with all the stuff that's up in Lemon Griffin's. We put Alfie in the pram and pile around him the pot, the pan, the kettle, the jam jars and mugs, the pope, two bolsters, and the coats from the beds. We drape the coats over our heads and push the pram through the streets. Ma'am tells us be quiet going up the lane, or the neighbours will know we got the eviction, and there will be shame. The pram has a bockety wheel which tilts it and makes it go in different directions. We try to keep it straight, and we're having a great time because it must be after midnight, and surely Ma'am won't make us go to school tomorrow. We're moving so far from Leamy's school, now maybe we'll never have to go again. Once we get away from the lane, Alfie bangs on the pot with the spoon, and Michael sings a song he heard in a film with Al Jolson.
Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee.
He makes us laugh the way he tries to sing in a deep voice like Al Jolson. Ma'am says she's glad it's late, and there's no one in the streets to see our shame. Once we get to the house, we take Alfie and everything else from the pram, so that Malachi and I can run back down to Roden Lane for the trunk. Ma'am says she'd die if she lost that trunk and everything in it. Malachi and I sleep at opposite ends of the small bed. Ma'am takes the big bed with Alfie beside her and Michael at the bottom. Everything is damp and musty, and Lemon Griffin snores over our heads.
There are no stairs in this house, and that means no angel ever on the seventh step. But I'm 12 going on 13, and I might be too old for angels. It's still dark when the alarm goes off in the morning, and Lamon Griffin snorts and blows his nose and hawks the stuff from his chest. The floor creaks under him, and when he pisses for ages into the chamber pot, we have to stuff our mouths with coats to stop the laughing, and Mam hisses at us to be quiet. He grumbles away above us before he climbs down to get his bicycle and bang his way out the door. Mam whispers, "The coast is clear, you go back to sleep, you can stay at home today." We can't sleep. We're in a new house, we have to pee and we want to explore. The lavatory is outside, about 10 steps from the back door. Our own lavatory, with a door you can close and a proper seat where you can sit and read squares of the Limerick leader Lamon Griffin left behind for wiping himself. There's a long backyard, a garden with tall grass and weeds, an old bicycle that must have belonged to a giant, tin cans galore, old papers and magazines rotting into the earth, a rusted sewing machine, a dead cat with a rope around his neck that somebody must have thrown over the fence. Michael gets a notion in his head that this is Africa and keeps asking, "Where's Tarzan? Where's Tarzan?" He runs up and down the backyard with no pants on, trying to imitate Tarzan yodeling from tree to tree. Maliki looks over the fences into the other yards and tells us, "They have gardens. They're growing things. We can grow things. We can have our own spuds and everything." Mam calls from the back door, "See if you can find anything to start the fire in here." There's a wooden shed built against the back of the house. It's collapsing, and surely we could use some of the wood for the fire. Mam is disgusted with the wood we bring in. She says it's rotten and full of white maggots, but beggars can't be choosers. The wood sizzles above the burning paper, and we watch the white maggots trying to escape. Michael says he feels sorry for the white maggots, but we know he's sorry for everything in the world. Mam tells us this house used to be a shop, that Lamon Griffin's mother sold groceries through the little window, and that's how she was able to send Lamon away to Rockwell College, so that he could wind up as an officer in the Royal Navy. Oh, he was indeed an officer in the Royal Navy, and here's a picture of him with other officers, all having dinner with a famous American film star, Jean Harlow. He was never the same after he met Jean Harlow. He fell madly in love with her, but what was the use? She was Jean Harlow, and he was nothing but an officer in the Royal Navy, and it drove him to drink, and they threw him out of the Navy. Now look at him, a common laborer for the Electricity Supply Board, and a house that's a disgrace. You'd look at this house and never know there was a human being living in it. You could see Lamon never moved a thing since his mother died, and now we have to clean up so that we can live in this place. There are boxes packed with bottles of purple hair oil. While Mam is out in the lavatory, we open a bottle and smear it on our heads. Maliki says the smell is gorgeous, but when Mam comes back, she says, "What's that horrible stink?" and wants to know why our heads are suddenly greasy. She makes us stick our heads under the tap outside and dry ourselves with an old towel pulled out from under a pile of magazines called the Illustrated London News. So old they have pictures of Queen Victoria and Prince Edward waving. There are bars of Pears soap and a thick book called Pears Encyclopedia, which keeps me up day and night because it tells you everything about everything. And that's all I want to know. There are bottles of Sloan's liniment, which Mam says will come in handy when we get cramps and pains from the damp. The bottles say, "Here's the pain, where's the Sloan's?" There are boxes of safety pins and bags packed with women's hats that crumble when you touch them. There are bags with corsets, garters, women's high-button shoes, and different laxatives that promise glowing cheeks, bright eyes, and a curl in your hair. There are letters from General Owen O'Duffy to Gerald Griffin, Esquire, saying, "Welcome to the ranks of the National Front, the Irish Blue Shirts. that it is a privilege to know a man like Gerard Griffin is interested in the movement with his excellent education, his Royal Navy training, his reputation as a great rugby player on the Young Munster team that won the national championship, the Bateman Cup. General O'Duffy is forming an Irish brigade that will soon sail off to Spain to fight with that great Catholic Generalissimo Franco himself, and Mr. Griffin would be a powerful addition to the brigade. Mam says Lamon's mother wouldn't let him go. She didn't spend all those years slaving away in a little shop to send him to college so that he could go gallivanting off to Spain for Franco. So he stayed at home and got that job, digging holes for the poles of the electricity supply board along country roads, and his mother was happy to have him home to herself every night but Friday, when he drank his pint and mourned over Jean Harlow. Mam is happy we'll have loads of paper for lighting the fire, though the wood we burn from that collapsing shed leaves a sickening smell, and she worries the white maggots will escape and breed. We work all day moving boxes and bags to the shed outside. Mam opens all the windows to air the house and let out the smell of the hair oil and the years of no air. She says it's a relief to be able to see the floor again, and now we can sit down and have a nice cup of tea in peace, ease and comfort. And won't it be lovely when the warm weather comes, and we might be able to have a garden and sit outside with our tea, the way the English do? Lamon Griffin comes home at 6 every night but Friday, has his tea and goes to bed till next morning. Saturdays he goes to bed at 1 in the afternoon and stays there till Monday morning. He pulls the kitchen table over to the wall under the loft, climbs up on a chair, pulls the chair up to the table, climbs up on the chair again, catches the leg of the bed, pulls himself up. If he's too drunk on Fridays, he makes me climb up for his pillow and blankets, and sleeps on the kitchen floor by the fire, or falls into bed with me and my brothers and snores and farts all night. When we first moved in, he complained over how he gave up his room downstairs for the loft, and he's worn out climbing up and down to go to the lavatory in the backyard. He calls down, "Bring the table, the chair, I'm coming down." And we have to clear off the table and pull it to the wall. He's fed up. He's finished with the climbing. He's going to use his mother's lovely chamber pot. He lies in bed all day, reading books from the library, smoking gold flake cigarettes, and throwing Mam a few shillings to send one of us to the shop so that he can have scones with his tea or a nice bit of ham and sliced tomato. Then he calls to Mam, "Angela, this chamber pot is full." And she drags chair and table to climb for the chamber pot, empty it in the lavatory outside, rinse it, and climb back to the loft. Her face gets tight and she says, "Is there anything else your lordship would like this day?" And he laughs, "Woman's work, Angela, woman's work, and free rent." Lamon throws down his library card from the loft and tells me get him two books, one on angling, one on gardening. He writes a note to the librarian to say his legs are killing him from digging holes for the electricity supply board, and from now on, Frank McCourt will be getting his books. He knows the boy is only 13 going on 14, and he knows the rules are strict about allowing children into the adult part of the library, but the boy will wash his hands and behave himself and do what he's told, thank you. The librarian reads the note and says, "'Tis an awful pity about Mr. Griffin. He's a true gentleman and a man of great learning. You wouldn't believe the books he reads, sometimes 4 a week, that one day he took home a book in French, French, if you don't mind, on the history of the rudder, if you don't mind. She'd give anything for a look inside his head, for it must be packed with all sorts of learning, packed.' If you don't mind." She picks out a gorgeous book with coloured pictures about English gardens. She says, "I know what he likes in the fishing department," and chooses a book called In Search of the Irish Salmon by Brigadier General Hugh Colton.
Oh, says the librarian, he reads hundreds of books about English officers fishing in Ireland. I've read some myself out of pure curiosity, and you can see why those officers are glad to be in Ireland after all they put up with in India and Africa and other desperate places. At least the people here are polite. We're known for that, the politeness, not running around throwing spears at people.
Lamont lies in the bed, reads his books, talks down from the loft about the day his legs will heal, and he'll be out there in the back planting a garden which will be famous far and wide for colour and beauty. And when he's not gardening, he'll be roaming the rivers around Limerick and bringing home salmon that will make your mouth water. His mother left a recipe for salmon that's a family secret, and if he had the time and his legs weren't killing him, he'd find it someplace in this house. He says, now that I'm reliable, I can get a book for myself every week, but don't be bringing home filth. I want to know what the filth is, but he won't tell me, so I'll have to find out for myself. Mam says she wants to join the library too, but it's a long walk from Lemon's house, 2 miles, and would I mind getting her a book every week, a romance by Charlotte M. Brame or any other nice writer? She doesn't want any books about English officers looking for salmon or books about people shooting each other. There's enough trouble in the world without reading about people bothering fish and each other. Grandma caught a chill the night we had the trouble in the house in Roden Lane, and the chill turned into pneumonia. They shifted her to the City Home Hospital, and now she's dead. Her oldest son, my Uncle Tom, thought he'd go to England to work like the other men in the lanes of Limerick, but his consumption got worse and he came back to Limerick, and now he's dead. His wife, Galway Jane, followed him, and 4 of their 6 children had to be put into orphanages. The oldest boy, Jerry, ran away and joined the Irish Army, deserted, and crossed to the English Army. The oldest girl, Peggy, went to Aunt Aggie and lives in misery. The Irish Army is looking for boys who are musical and would like to train in the Army School of Music. They accept my brother Malachy, and he goes off to Dublin to be a soldier and play the trumpet. Now I have only 2 brothers at home, and Mam says her family is disappearing before her very eyes. Boys from my class at Leamy School are going on a weekend cycling trip to Killaloe. They tell me I should borrow a bicycle and come. All I need is a blanket, a few spoons of tea and sugar, and a few cuts of bread to keep me going. I learned to cycle on Lemon Griffin's bicycle every night after he goes to bed, and he'll surely let me borrow it for 2 days in Killaloe. The best time to ask him for anything is Friday night, when he's in a good mood after his night of drinking and his dinner. He brings home the same dinner in his overcoat pockets, a big steak, dripping blood, 4 potatoes, an onion, a bottle of stout. Mam boils the potatoes and fries the steak with sliced onion. He keeps his overcoat on, sits at the table and eats the steak out of his hands. The grease and blood roll down his chin and onto the overcoat, where he wipes his hands. He drinks his stout and laughs that there's nothing like a great bloody steak of a Friday night. And if that's the worst sin he ever commits, he'll float to heaven, body and soul. Ha, ha, ha. Of course you can have my bike, he says. Boy should be able to get out and see the countryside. Of course. But you have to earn it. You can't be getting something for nothing. Isn't that right? Tis. And I have a job for you. You don't mind doing a bit of a job, do you?
I don't.
And you'd like to help your mother?
I would.
Well, now, that very chamber pot is full since this morning. I want you to climb up and get it and take it to the lavatory and rinse it under the tap abroad and climb back up with it. I don't want to empty his chamber pot, but I dream of cycling miles on the road to Killaloe, fields and sky far from this house, a swim in the Shannon, a night sleeping in a barn. I pull the table and chair to the wall. I climb up, and under the bed, there's the plain white chamber pot streaked brown and yellow, brimming with piss and shit. I lay it gently at the edge of the loft so that it won't spill, climb down to the chair, reach for the chamber pot, bring it down, turn my face away, hold it while I step down to the table, place it on the chair, step to the floor, take the chamber pot to the lavatory, empty it, and get sick behind the lavatory till I get used to this job. Lamont says I'm a good boy and the bike is mine any time I want it, as long as the chamber pot is empty. And I'm there to run to the shop for his cigarettes, go to the library for books, and do whatever else he wants. He says, "You have a great way with the chamber pot." He laughs, and Mam stares into the dead ashes in the fireplace. It's raining so hard one day, Miss O'Riordan, the librarian, says,
"Don't go out in that, or you'll ruin the books you're carrying. Sit down over there and behave yourself. You can read all about the saints while you're waiting."
There are four big books, Butler's Lives of the Saints. I don't want to spend my life reading about saints, but when I start, I wish the rain would last forever. Whenever you see pictures of saints, men or women, they're always looking up to heaven where there are clouds filled with little fat angels carrying flowers or harps, giving praise. Uncle Pat Keating says he can't think of a single saint in heaven he'd want to sit down and have a pint with. The saints in these books are different. There are stories about virgins, martyrs, virgin martyrs, and they're worse than any horror film at the Lyric Cinema. I have to look in the dictionary to find out what a virgin is. I know the Mother of God is the Virgin Mary, and they call her that because she didn't have a proper husband, only poor old Saint Joseph. In the lives of the saints, the virgins are always getting into trouble, and I don't know why. The dictionary says, "Virgin, woman, usually a young woman, who is and remains in a state of inviolate chastity." Now I have to look up inviolate and chastity, and all I can find here is that inviolate means not violated, and chastity means chaste, and that means pure from unlawful sexual intercourse. Now I have to look up intercourse, and that leads to intromission, which leads to intromittent, the copulatory organ of any male animal. Copulatory leads to copulation, the union of the sexes in the art of generation. And I don't know what that means. And I'm too weary going from one word to another in this heavy dictionary, which leads me on a wild goose chase from this word to that word, and all because the people who wrote the dictionary don't want the likes of me to know anything. All I want to know is where I came from, but if you ask anyone, they tell you, ask someone else, or send you from word to word. All these virgin martyrs are told by Roman judges that they have to give up their faith and accept the Roman gods, but they say, "Nay," and the judges have them tortured and killed. My favorite is St. Christina the Astonishing, who takes ages to die. The judge says, "Cut off her breast." And when they do, she throws it at him, and he goes deaf, dumb, and blind. Another judge is brought on the case, and he says, "Cut off the other breast." And the same thing happens. They try to kill her with arrows, but they just bounce off her and kill the soldiers who shot them. They try to boil her in oil, but she rocks in the vat and takes a nap for herself. Then the judges get fed up and have her head cut off. And that does the job. The feast of St. Christina the Astonishing is the 24th of July, and I think I'll keep that for myself, along with the feast of St. Francis of Assisi on the 4th of October. The librarian says, "You have to go home now. The rain has stopped." And when I'm going out the door, she calls me back. She wants to write a note to my mother, and she doesn't mind one bit if I read it. The note says, "Dear Mrs. McCourt, just when you think Ireland has gone to the dogs altogether, you find a boy sitting in the library so absorbed in the lives of the saints, he doesn't realize the rain has stopped.
and you have to drag him away from the aforesaid lives. I think, Mrs. McCourt, you might have a future priest on your hands, and I will light a candle in hopes it comes true. I remain...